Владимир Путин обратился к ополчению Донбасса.
Допустимо, об этом Владимир Путин заявил в телефонном разговоре.
Сейчас, по словам Путина, нужно дать солдатам возможность...
Российский президент был искренне рад видеть украинского...
Как заявил президент, очевидно, что ополчение достигло...
Российский президент назвал переговоры позитивными.
Знаете, ну, да...
It's tempting to assume that Vladimir Putin always has a master plan. And why not? He's cunning and he's shrewd. He's steely and he's ruthless. He's cold and he's calculating. And his political life has been so charmed that many Russians, as well as many Kremlin watchers, think he has an almost supernatural, or at least preternatural, ability to always come out on top. It's also long been conventional wisdom that important decisions in Russia are made by a so-called collective Putin, a cabal of oligarchs and security service veterans close to the Kremlin leader who make up the inner sanctum of Russia's deep state. But recently, Kremlin policy appears erratic, inconsistent, and sometimes downright incoherent. Is that all just part of the plan? Or is Putin himself becoming erratic, and is the collective Putin coming unglued? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies. Welcome, Sean.
Hey, Brian.
And joining us from New York City, making his first but hopefully not last appearance in the podcast, is Alexander Motil, a professor at Rutgers University, Newark, and author of numerous books on post-Soviet affairs. Welcome, Alexander. Great to have you aboard.
Thanks for having me.
And Alexander, by tradition, first-time guests get the honor of getting the ball rolling, so it's time to put you on the spot. Over the past couple weeks, it's appeared that Putin was looking maybe for a face-saving way to wind down this conflict in the east of Ukraine. But literally, as he was meeting with Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko, Putin turns around and escalates. There was also that odd spectacle of the aid convoy and the Kremlin hitting the mute button on Putin's big Yalta speech 2 weeks ago. What's your take? Is this a carefully thought-out plan, or is the Russian leadership becoming erratic?
Well, my sense is that Putin has been erratic from the very beginning. I frankly, by very beginning, arguably since 1999, but certainly since late 2013 with regard to the Ukraine crisis, his actions don't make sense at many times. He hasn't been terribly successful. People consider him to be very successful. I just don't see what he's achieved. If you consider that back in February of this year, he was at the apex of his glory, power, and fame. This is during the Olympics, of course. Russia was in good standing with the world. It was projecting its power throughout the world and was respected by many. Not by all, but certainly by many. And arguably, in November of 2013, he had Ukraine and Yanukovych in his pocket. What has he achieved in the last 7, 8, 9 or so months? Well, frankly, he's turned Russia into a rogue state. It's feared, but it's feared for all the wrong reasons, as it were. It's lost influence. It's certainly lost the, let's call it the formerly warm feelings that Ukrainians felt toward Russia and the Russian people. He's acquired a peninsula, the Crimea, which is an economic basket case. He's embarked on a war that looks like a dead end for everybody concerned. Even in the best case scenario for Putin, if he manages to hold on to the Donbass, he will be holding on to a region that's been economically devastated, demographically depopulated, and industrially deindustrialized. I mean, he's inheriting or fighting for the equivalent of a Hobbesian state of nature. None of that was necessary. Absolutely none of that was necessary. My own sense is that there is something in the nature of a vision that motivates him. And it obviously has something to do with the desire to project Russian greatness, restore its power, something to do with his own need to project this great power, this kind of strongman image that is so critical to his legitimacy. He obviously wants to punish the Ukrainians for embarking on democracy and turning toward Europe. There is no question about that. But in terms of the actual plan, it seems to me that there is a lot of improvisation and seat of the pants thinking. The one thing that is consistent throughout is that he prefers force to negotiation, to logic, to reason, and things of that sort. And inasmuch as much of the developed world, well, frankly, almost all of it, arguably with the semi-exception of the United States, doesn't understand the language of force, he's been able, as it were, to outmaneuver the Europeans. But it's not because he's clever. It's just because he's a thug. You know, when you take Mother Teresa and confront her with Al Capone, if the rules of the game are determined by Al Capone, Al will win. So in that sense, he looks like he knows what he's doing, but it's largely because he's simply been flailing about, beating up the Ukrainians, destroying the Donbass, and of course, in the process, beginning to destroy a significant portion of the Russian army and the Russian population.
Not to mention the Russian economy.
That's dangerous. That makes him arguably more dangerous, because here you have a guy who's willing to go and use violence, use force, use the military to achieve whatever goals he may or may not have in mind. And on the other hand, it's not clear what he wants. That's the other part of the problem. I mean, if we knew for sure that all he aspires to is A, B, or C, there is at least an opportunity here for Ukraine, for the West, for the international community to negotiate something resembling a solution. And, of course, that would be the desirable outcome. But the problem is that Putin, in addition to being mendacious, has continually changed his positions, and we frankly don't know what he wants. It may be the case that he wants to march Russian troops all the way to Lisbon. It's an argument. That position has been argued by very respectable Russian analysts. It may be the case that all he wants is a greater degree of autonomy for the Donbass. It may be the case that it's neither one nor the other, but something as minimal as destroying Ukraine. Mm. No one knows.
Sean, what's your take? Master plan, incoherence?
I think you ask a really good question, and this is something that people have been wondering about for several months now, and I think Alexander also pointed to it. What does Putin want? What is the end game here? What is he trying to achieve? And this has been a very murky and elusive thing, especially as we watch. And we, on the one hand, and on the podcast you were saying a couple of weeks ago, that maybe he's looking to extricate himself from this situation, that some solution might come to the end, you know, come to fruition. But other actions on his part suggest that he's escalating. So there's kind of this back and forth. And it does bring the question back to how are decisions being made and who's in charge of decisions and who is in what kind of advisors are around Putin. Now, if you recall several months ago, I wrote a blog post suggesting that this crisis produced Putin in his autocratic moment, that the nationalism, this nationalism kind of swirling around the Ukrainian crisis in Russia prevents elites around him from speaking out, at least, certainly publicly, but perhaps even privately, to kind of alter the course. Now, we do have some indication that within the Kremlin, it's split between doves and hawks. And those doves and hawks seem to be based on the doves being more people who are connected to the banking sector and the economy, and the hawks connected to those in the military. And by looking at the decision-making on the part of Putin, on one hand, it suggests that the doves are having some influence. And then on the other, it suggests that the hawks are having some influence. And it's really hard to pin down what's going on. And I know that there's some indications, or at least some whispers, that Putin's become more isolated. Yes. And perhaps he's making decisions on his own. and not really taking the advice of his advisors, whatever that advice means. I mean, this is all speculative, and this is what makes it really difficult.
This is the trouble here. It's supposition upon supposition. But what we can't hang on, if not some facts, at least some suppositions that seem pretty solid that we've gotten recently. Ben Judah was speaking on the podcast last week about how Putin's becoming people are saying Putin's becoming increasingly isolated. I don't know what that means. Is he locking himself in a room with the patriarch and Dugin or what? But it certainly appears that way. And the other thing is that the communications channels among the informal communications channels among the so-called collective Putin, where the real decisions are made, because let's face it, they're not made in the government or the Duma. They're made among the collective Putin, and the rest is a rubber stamp, that those communication channels have broken down. And so it's really unclear right now to me, even if there is a collective Putin anymore. And if there is a collective Putin, who the hell is in it? And this is where it gets really, really erratic. I saw a couple of things over the past few weeks that just gave me pause. I mean, if you rewind back to, say, August 7th, right? The Kremlin was hyping a big statement Putin was going to make that night. Right. They were talking about a major announcement Putin was going to make. And then, poof, it never happened. Fast forward a week from that, Putin's big speech in Yalta that we talked about on the podcast at length 2 weeks ago. They pulled the plug on this thing at the last minute for the broadcast. The speech happened. The meeting with the Duma deputies happened. But they pulled the plug on the broadcast. Now, this is something, if the Kremlin does one thing well, it's put on a damn show. And this is a chance to really put on a show, but they pulled the plug on it at the last minute. But then what really, really gave me pause was the 26th of August, this Tuesday, right after Putin's meeting with Poroshenko, the 2 hours of meetings in Minsk with Poroshenko. Putin came out to give a press conference, and I watched this thing, and it blew my mind. Because, like, I've been watching Putin for a long time, and this was not the Putin that I've come to know throughout his time in Petersburg and his rise to the presidency. It wasn't the arrogant, self-assured Putin. He was swaying back and forth. He was making weird facial gestures that were like inappropriate to the moment. It was just very, very, very odd. And even one journalist wrote on Facebook, well, now I see why they didn't show the Crimea speech on television. They're suggesting maybe something is wrong with Putin. This is supposition, but after watching that press conference on the 26th, I thought something's not quite right. I mean, I'm not going to go as far as to say he's lost the plot or anything like that, because, again, we don't know. But something is different there with Putin, and something certainly is different with the collective Putin. Now, what does that portend, though, as we move forward now? Because this thing is reaching, it's moving into a critical juncture. I mean, Russia has invaded by all definitions of the term invasion, although they're denying that their troops are even there. The U.S. called it a protracted incursion. Well, that's an invasion. An incursion is when you go in and then go out. If you protracted incursion to this length of time, it becomes an invasion. What does this portend, though, if you have if things have become this dysfunctional, or are we off base here? And maybe there is some diabolical master plan here. I don't know. What does this all portend if it gets this? Is it going to get more dangerous?
It seems to me that Putin's policy in Ukraine has essentially been a failure. Now, if you speak to Ukrainians, they may not agree with that assessment because they see Putin's forces amassed on the borders and they've lost territory. But after that lightning, the blitzkrieg in the Crimea, bloodless, rapid annexation of a province, glory, feelings of pride, and all that kind of stuff permeating Russia and the Russian psyche. Essentially, everything since mid-March through now hasn't quite worked out. You've got the Donetsk Republic, you've got the Luhansk Republic. They have the support of a certain percentage of the population. It doesn't seem to be more than 10, 15, or 20% at the very most. They weren't doing well in terms of their armed confrontation with the Ukrainian army. they've lost the battle for the hearts and minds of the international community and of a significant segment of the population of the Donbass, and certainly of the rest of eastern Ukraine, southeastern Ukraine, which is always supposed to be pro-Russian in some fashion or other. So the policy, which was presumably, again, we're guessing, the policy of having these locals start insurgencies, sending in green, the little green men and the armaments and so on, presumably the hope was that this would lead to an explosion of popular enthusiasm. The two referenda would serve as a kind of capstone for this. Kiev would accept a fait accompli, and you'd have some kind of autonomous, quasi-independent Donbass, end of story, and you have another feather in Putin's cap. Well, clearly that hasn't happened.
Right.
Worse, as I said before, the Donbass has actually become an economic and socioeconomic hellhole. I mean, this is the territory, these are the people that Putin wanted, quote, to liberate, and instead he and his forces have done almost everything to make their lives utterly impossible.
But what makes me nervous right now is that they seem to be moving beyond this phase of these fake local insurgencies. And if the Russian armed forces wanted to, they could push through to Mariupol, perhaps to Odessa. Whether or not those places in both of those cities, and I lived in Odessa, and God, I could have told Putin this. I lived in Odessa in the 90s for a year. They don't want any part of this, right? They don't want any part of anything like this. But regardless of what they want, the Russian armed forces could push through there if they want to.
Well, again, or could they? If they want to. I mean, remember, the Russian army is about 750,000. If Putin were to send all 750,000 soldiers into Ukraine, he could obviously overrun it. That would be the equivalent of World War III. It would open up the border to Chinese incursions, protracted or otherwise, and so on. The point is, for Putin to seize the littoral, the oblast, right, ranging, say, from Donetsk to Odessa, considering the level of resistance, which is almost certain to ensue, and that would be a very high level of resistance, both by the army, by partisans and the local population, he would have to deploy upwards of 150,000 troops. Now, again, he could obviously send a column of tanks. They could arrive in Odessa, but then what?
Right.
You have to occupy and administer a territory. And for that,
a territory that doesn't want to be occupied, administered, or quote unquote liberated.
So that requires a major, major deployment of forces. Even something like Mariupol, it's 500,000 population. The population does not seem to be enthusiastically pro-Russian.
To say the least.
The army, the Ukrainian army, has dug in. So we're talking about a major, major military involvement. Now, again, Putin may want to do that. But the point is, it won't be a cakewalk. It's not the sort of thing you can do with 20 tanks and 1,000 Russian paratroopers. We're talking about a significant escalation of Russian forces at that point.
So the goal has to be a little bit more modest. Now, I wrote on the blog yesterday about how maybe perhaps one of the memes that's in the Russian media right now is that the end game is another to freeze the conflict, to freeze the Donbass, to have another Abkhazia, South Ossetia, Transnistria, another little unrecognized statelet that's essentially a Russian protectorate in the Donbass and get as much continuous territory as possible. And that's tricky because they don't have a lot of continuous territory right now. But that might be the end game. Sean, what do you think of that? Do you think that's where they're trying to go with this?
Yeah, I think the minimum that they're trying to achieve is to freeze the conflict and freeze it in a way that Poroshenko won't, or Kiev in general, won't be able to govern the eastern part of Ukraine, that it'll be in a constant state of upheaval. And this will destabilize Ukraine and prevent it from getting it back on its feet, and allow for Russia to penetrate its power into the region gradually. I mean, to turn it into a Transnistria or a Abkhazia. I think this is the minimal goal for what they're looking at. But I think back to your your discussion of how Putin looked at this press conference. Now, I think it's clear from his kind of – and this has shown up repeatedly in the last month or so, this kind of uncomfortableness he has. He's clearly – and many people have said this in the Western press that he's backed into a corner. And this corner is, of course, a lot of it is self-made. It's self-made through the repeated denial. And even to the point of yesterday with the incursion or invasion, however you call it, of Russian troops, the complete denial that this is occurring. So their denial has backed them into a corner. The propaganda has backed them in the corner. They've made a bluster about the Novaya Russia project, the Russian greatness, the fear of fascism on their borders. And he's fed the population this and has difficulty in backing down, because what does he say if he de-escalates this to the end? And the last thing is that backs him in the corner is that it's unclear exactly what he wants, exactly what Alexander said. Nobody knows exactly what Putin wants, what he's trying to achieve in destabilizing Ukraine. And I think that freezing the conflict allows for an effort to not make a decision as to what he wants. By freezing it, he can go on as things are going and further destabilize Ukraine.
But you have to wonder when, and because as much as it's alluring to think about it, Putin it is not in this alone. I mean, the Russian decision making was and always will be kind of a collective endeavor. It's a country that's always run by some form of oligarchy or collective Putin or Politburo or court or whatever you want to call it. But the decision making is collective, and there seems to be Yevgenia Albats put this perfectly on Echo Moskvy last week. She said there's a fight between those in the elite who truly want a confrontation with the West. Bring it on. Right. And those who understand that this is suicide because, well, all our money's in the West, by the way. Right. And so it's at the very least economic suicide. And it seems to be wavering back and forth. But one has to wonder when, as Mark Eliade always points out in the podcast, the point when Putin's really in trouble is when a critical mass of the elite considers him a liability. And I'm wondering if he's not teetering dangerously close to that point right now. Especially when the next wave of sanctions come through. Alexander, your thoughts?
I'm inclined to agree with you on that. Sean makes a very good point about these corners. I mean, having backed himself into a variety of corners. And mind you, these are all corners that Putin constructed, or the collective Putin. But certainly Putin is the one who's been articulating these corners, as it were. I would argue, however, that, I mean, I would just take this a little further. Namely, I would argue that even a frozen conflict is a corner for Putin. Because remember, Transnistria, Abkhazia, South Ossetia, you know, they witnessed some fighting, but were pretty much economically and socially intact after the fighting. Now, none of them is a thriving Switzerland, of course, but the point is there wasn't a radical decline in the economic and social status of these regions. The Donbass has been devastated. Right. I mean, if the place becomes some kind of quasi-vassal state of Russia, in a way, Russia would be doing Ukraine an enormous favor. You know, I mean, who needs this? It's not just economically depressed, which was the case, you know, a half a year ago, but it is now physically devastated.
Right.
I mean, the cost of reconstruction would entail billions of dollars. And of course, who knows whether any of the people who've left, who are likely to be the middle class professional types, are likely to return to the zone anyway.
I can't help but recall an interview we had back in the very early days of this whole thing, Alexander, when you very articulately argued that this was before there was any little green men or anything. That was during the Euromaidan, if I'm not mistaken, that it would be the best thing possible for Ukraine would be to let the Donbass go. You made some very controversial comments at the time, and I couldn't resist printing them. but I can't help but recall that now. Sean, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, I wanted to say that, you know, this devastation of eastern Ukraine and the Donbass being a headache for Russia. Yeah, it is. It would be an economic headache, but not for some. Just a few days ago in Vedomosti, there was an article about how the Rotenbergs and Timchenko were possibly getting the contracts to build the bridge across the Kerch Strait.
Right.
This allows
predictable.
For this reconstruction that would be necessary in eastern Ukraine would allow for a lot of corruption for Russian elites. This was the excellent opportunity for some Ruspil and shave off government funds into their pockets.
Yeah, and Navalny could make a whole new website if he stays out of jail, just devoted
Yeah, the cynical part of me sees this as a golden opportunity for members of Russia's elite in the long term.
Well, let's face it, that's what each one of these frozen conflicts turned into one way or the other. It turned into a little the goose that laid the golden egg for one oligarch or the other. There's another reason, though, why the frozen conflict scenario is not going to be why I don't think it's going to resemble the frozen conflict scenarios in Transnistria, South Ossetia, and Abkhazia. And that is because those conflicts happened in the chaos immediately following the collapse of the Soviet Union. And to an uninformed outside observer, which most of the West, let's face it, is, it just looked like a continuation of that process. If Georgia can declare independence from the Soviet Union, then why can't Abkhazia declare independence from Georgia and South Ossetia? And why can't Transnistria? It looked like that. The West really wasn't paying attention, and Russia was able to pursue its goals by stealth. They were able to provoke a conflict or stoke an existing manageable conflict into one that was no longer manageable, and then come in and play the role of the peacekeeper and create a de facto protectorate, right? And they've maintained that role, for God's sakes, to this day in Transnistria. After the Georgia War, they had to relinquish that role in Abkhazia and South Ossetia, where they simply recognized them as independent states. But now the mask is off. The mask is off. Everybody that's paying attention and everybody that's serious knows what's going on in the Donbass, and they're not going to be able to do that this time. It's going to resemble more an East-West Berlin kind of thing this time, because the West is going to be not going to be a partner with Russia or a facilitator of this, an unwitting facilitator in this. They're going to be, I would think, in opposition to it. So creating another frozen conflict is going to be costly for Russia. Where creating those other frozen conflicts was not costly for Russia at all. They were able to reap the benefits of it with no costs. Sean, you look like you wanted to say something.
I would agree with you. I mean, this is coming at a lot of cost and a lot of future cost. And this suggests, of course, that the people who have Putin's ear are the ones who are begging for a confrontation with the West. If we understand the decision-making as a small collective around Putin and how decisions are made, this suggests that the hawks are ascendant in this respect.
But I have to wonder who the hawks are right now. When we used to break down the collective Putin, we'd break it down into, you know, the hardliners were your Sechins and your Ivanovs and on one hand, and your Dubs were your Kudrins and your Dvorkoviches. You know, now I'm not – I mean, where is Igor Sechin on this? He's the CEO of Rosneft, for God's sakes. I mean, you tell me Rosneft isn't losing as a result of this? They just asked for $13 billion in state subsidies, saying they're going to have to go into default if they didn't get it. So, I mean, if you're – your traditional hardliners also have ties to industry that has benefited from Russia's integration into the global economy and have a lot to lose. So I'm really wondering – I was only half joking when I said, is he locked in a room with Dugin and the Patriarch? You know, because one has to wonder who does have his ear right now. I mean, any thoughts on that, Alexander?
Well, I share your befuddlement on the one hand. And, you know, the easy answer is it's likely to be individuals within the security apparatus. But who exactly those individuals are, what exactly their positions are, is, of course, unclear. What seems to be clear is that there, as Sean said before, I mean, there are clearly divisions within the ruling elite. We know there are divisions. There always are divisions in every ruling elite, regardless. I mean, that's just an a priori true statement of any particular political elite. And clearly, Putin's ability to sustain the cohesiveness of the elite and arguably his legitimacy and power depends on his ability to push through something resembling a semi-successful policy. Again, these are all bromides. None of this is terribly insightful, but it's obviously true. We poo-poo very often the sanctions, but the sanctions are taking a bite. And there's no way that Russia will prosper in isolation from the global economy. And it is now in the process of becoming isolated from the global economy. Putin can beat his chest and say we can substitute for everything that we've been importing. But, of course, every economist and business person will know that's just nonsense. So he's under pressure, clearly. He's under pressure because things aren't working out as they should be working out. And he's under pressure because presumably there are forces within this collective Putin that are getting somewhat nervous, who are looking at Russia's medium, short-term, medium, or longer-term prospects and saying, hey, where is all of this going? One might even throw into the mix the possibility that there's some sense of pressure being felt from the population. I mean, I'm not so sure he terribly cares about what the people think. That said, the increasing numbers of body bags and the awareness that this war isn't going to be a glorious, quick campaign a la Crimea may begin to shift some popular opinion, which may not impact on Putin, but may have an impact on economic sectors, economic right. elites, who will yeah. then translate that into some kind of influence on Putin.
Yeah, no, and I want to talk about the population in the second half of the program. I mean, one of the things that I, before we move on to that, just one last point. I mean, one of the things that's always that has always been Putin's source of strength is he was the great decider. He was the arbiter of consensus within this collective Putin. That was Putin's role, and that's what made him valuable. Because while the other members of the collective Putin didn't trust each other, everybody trusted Putin to be an honest broker, but he's lost that now. He's lost that, and they're in the, and he doesn't seem to be brokering consensus in what is a pretty fundamental and perhaps existential question right now. About, because this could become existential for this regime. Any last thoughts from either of you before we move on to the second part where we'll talk about society?
Yeah, back to the elite and why it's difficult to say. Sure, there's different factions within elite, but in terms of them turning on Putin, the question then becomes, in all of these situations that foreign policy and nationalism and fighting enemies consolidates the society and consolidates the elite. And if the elite would begin to turn against Putin, they would be faced with the problem of, well, do you really want to destabilize Russia internally?
Right.
I mean, that might be a worse fate than the fate that they're dealing with right now with the economic sanctions, et cetera. Destabilizing Russia might be a worse nightmare than what they have at the present.
Yeah. No, I've been waiting for, you know, Yevgeny Minchenko, you put out these periodic reports of Putin's Politburo, right? I haven't seen one in a while. And I think I know why, because it is pretty confusing to see the elite doesn't appear to be consolidated, but I've never seen it so opaque as right now. I mean, we've always been able to, you know, pull together who's in, who's out, what's the collective Putin look like, what's its orientation. It's very opaque. Well, in a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and take a look at how the war in Ukraine is now coming home for Russians. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian Eastern European Studies. And joining us from New York City, also via Skype, is Alexander Motil, a professor at Rutgers University, Newark, and author of numerous books on post-Soviet affairs. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. If there was any doubt before, there isn't any now. Russian troops are in Ukraine. You can call it an invasion, you can call it an incursion, you can call it, as the Kremlin remarkably did when Ukrainian forces captured 10 Russian paratroopers, an accident. But they're there, no doubt. Boots on the ground. This certainly changes the military balance in Donbass, but what it also changes is the political calculus in Russia, because Russian troops are now being captured and are now dying in Ukraine. Russian media has reported on a series of secret funerals in Pskov Oblast and elsewhere. The Committee for Soldiers' Mothers has compiled a list of 400 servicemen who were killed or wounded in the conflict and released an emotional video, which we just heard a clip from, calling on Putin to bring the boys home. And all this while the Kremlin continues to deny that Russian troops are even there. A majority of Russians supported the government's actions in Ukraine when the costs were low. But now comes the real test. Sean, what do you think? Does what we've seen over the past week with these paratroopers captured, the reports of the secret funerals in Pskov, does this change the nature of the war at home? Do you see this becoming less popular now?
I mean, this is a good question, and some indications suggest that it might make it more unpopular. FOM had a poll that came out a couple of days ago, and granted, it's FOM, but it's also revealing the fact that only 5% in this poll supported armed intervention in Ukraine. There was a poll that came out on the Levada Center today that asked, would you support the leadership if there was a real conflict, if there was a war between Russia and Ukraine? And 41% said yes, but 43% said no. So it does present a public problem, especially if you have these soldiers' mothers organizations speaking out. It conjures up really horrible reminders of Chechnya and the secretive nature of whether Russian troops are in Ukraine or not. The deniability of the government brings back horrible memories of Afghanistan as well. So it could present a problem.
Yeah, and it's no accident that today soldiers' mothers was declared a foreign agent.
That
came over the wire a few months. Interesting, that poll. I mean, if you flip it around, 95%, because Russians have intervened. There is a Russian armed intervention in Ukraine. It's happened. Mm-hmm. So therefore, 95% of Russians, according to a FOM poll, you know, which is a pro-Kremlin outfit, are opposed to current Kremlin policy. It's all how you ask the question, right? But that is very, very revealing. Alexander, what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, we do have to keep in mind that this is an authoritarian regime. I've gone on record since 2007 arguing that it's a fascist regime. But call it what you like, then it's in the nature of such hyper-centralized authoritarian regimes to be at least somewhat indifferent to public opinion and to be manipulative of public opinion. And we know that's the case. So that, on the one hand, I have no doubt that these increasing casualties will make it more difficult for the Kremlin to maintain its hegemony over public opinion, or at least over the kinds of forms of public opinion that are manifested publicly and can therefore be filmed in order to suggest that the reality is very different from what people are perhaps thinking. On the other hand, it is clearly the case, and we know this from any number of countries, that as casualties mount, as people begin to lose their own sons or husbands or boyfriends or just friends, they begin to question the veracity of the propaganda and begin to question the veracity of media accounts. So my own sense is that the longer this takes, the more casualties there are, especially if the fighting becomes far greater, more intense. For instance, an assault on Mariupol, which would presumably entail street fighting of some kind or other. In other words, the greater, the longer, and the more intense, the more body bags and the more difficult things will be for Putin. This suggests to me that he needs to find a resolution quickly, or more quickly, you know, quicker rather than later.
Right, time's not on his side, right.
The longer this drags out, the more complicated it could become. The sooner he does this, of course, the better it is for him in all sorts of respects. So that just adds to the time pressure. What can he do quickly other than reestablish control over bits and pieces of the territory of the Donbass?
Well, and another important variable in here is Ukraine itself. Now, Alexander, you follow Ukraine, of course, very, 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 very closely. Is this a society that's ready to fight? I mean, because a lot of it's going to depend on that. My assumption is that if Russia does, you know, go for the whole hog, and you know, which would start with Mariupol, my feeling is that Ukrainians would fight and fight hard, and this isn't going to be a cakewalk. This is going to resemble. It's not going to be Afghanistan. It's not going to be Chechnya. But it's not going to be like the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia either.
No, anything but. Back in March or February after the invasion of Crimea, those sorts of questions, would the Ukrainians fight, would the army fight, would the militias fight, and so on, were perfectly legitimate because no one had any notion. Ukraine had never faced this kind of situation, and the working assumption is that Ukrainians would be unlikely to want to engage in hostile behavior vis-a-vis a fraternal nation like right. Russia, and so on and so forth. Clearly, the last 6 months have changed that perspective. I mean, the army is by and large reliable. It's been doing by and large, with some significant exceptions, but by and large it's been fighting well. What is extremely important in terms of this question of is the population willing to fight is the emergence of these volunteer battalions. I had an opportunity back in June to converse with some 20 to 30 members of the Donbass battalion. These were almost all Russian speakers, almost exclusively from the Donbass, many of whom were Russians, and they were willing to put their lives on the line in defense of something called Ukraine. Frankly, I was a little shocked, I was a little surprised, because I wasn't quite expecting that kind of enthusiasm. Mm. So there is much more. And of course, the further west you go, the greater that enthusiasm is to be. So if Putin goes in with the intention of occupying, say, the southeast or the left bank, or arguably even to go off as far as Lviv, and he will be encountering massive resistance. This will be anything but a cakewalk. This will be a massive land war with enormous casualties for everybody, of course, for everybody. But the Russians are going to suffer enormously. The internal minister of Ukraine just recently said, let the Russians try to capture Mariupol. If they do, we'll be sending back trucks full of body bags. Mm.
Well, then, and this raises another issue you alluded to, Alexander. I want to get Sean's thoughts on this as well. The prospect of Slavs fighting Slavs, I mean, Russians fighting Ukrainians, particularly not just Slavs fighting Slavs, but Russians fighting Ukrainians, the impact that this could have in Russia. I mean, I don't know the exact statistics, but a lot, anecdotally, I know a lot of Russians have Ukrainian relatives. I don't have the statistics, but so many Russians that I encountered in all my time in Russia had some Ukrainian blood. And one has to wonder, this is not, and you could talk about Banderovtsi and Nazis all you want. At the end of the day, you're talking about Ukrainians. This is something Russians know very, very well. Sean, what is the prospect of that domestically? I mean, if this does turn into, if they do decide to escalate this.
I mean, if it is escalated, it comes to the question who has the stomach to really fight. And as Alexander said, and I completely agree, the Ukrainians are willing to fight.
Right.
The one thing that the situation the Russians have created is Ukrainian unity and Ukrainian national pride. On the Russian side, what is the real question? What is the state of the Russian population and how do they feel about this, considering the ethnic ties, the familial ties, the cultural ties? Do they really have – I mean, this might come to a shock to them. Are we really fighting Ukrainians? How would this resonate through the population? We don't really know, but I don't think it's going to be a smooth sailing rah, rah, rah for war against Ukraine.
No, I mean – good.
Second?
Yes.
I mean, I'd like to pick up on Sean's point very, very importantly. I mean, for Ukrainians, the war has been a shock because they weren't expecting a fraternal nation to be attacking it. And precisely because of that, again, by fraternal nation, I mean Putin, essentially. Nevertheless, and that has, of course, reoriented them in the direction that Sean has said, established some sense of stronger national identity. For Russians, who are still under the delusion, many Russians were under the delusion that Ukraine is ruled by a fascist junta that is discriminating against Russian language, culture, and Russian speakers. The incursion and the arrival of such Russians in Ukraine has been, thus far, we have some anecdotal evidence of this, has been a shock. They've encountered people who are saying, you know, we like Russians. We speak Russian. We've got no problem with this. Why are you here? And I suspect that as, in a way, then, an escalation will be more of a shock for the Russians. The initial shock for the Ukrainians took place in February and March.
Right. No, and one of the biggest, I mean, surprises that came out of this, I mean, I say I wasn't surprised that Odessa didn't want any part of this, but I am surprised to a degree the extent of loyalty among Russian speakers in the South and parts of the East to the Ukrainian state. They, I mean, we this comes across in interview after interview that our services are doing on the ground of the degree of loyalty that Russian speakers, ethnic Russian speakers from places like Odessa and Mariupol, Dnipropetrovsk or what have you, do feel this strong loyalty to the Ukrainian state. And this is something, there was always this stereotype that the East was pro-Moscow and the West was pro-West. And but it's Ukraine doesn't appear to be as divided as we used to think it was, no? And it might be Russia at the end of the day that ends up being divided about this.
I mean, I personally, there was always, as you said, there was this stereotype of a homogeneous, monolithic, Ukrainian-speaking West versus a homogeneous, monolithic, Russian-speaking East. And of course, if one were to look at the polar ends, say you take Lviv Oblast on the one hand versus Luhansk on the other, that may have been true. But it would be similar to comparing Southern California with Maine.
Right.
The problem was that that particular division between Lviv and Luhansk, and it was often actually positioned in terms of Lviv versus Donetsk, was then transposed on the rest of the country, which would be the equivalent of saying that there is a monolithic America west of the Mississippi versus one east of the Mississippi. And we lost sight of the gradations. And the gradations are enormous, both in terms of language use, both in terms of feeling, you know, in feelings regarding, you know, mother tongue, both in terms of political preferences. I mean, there has always been far more diversity politically in places like Dnipropetrovsk and some of the other sort of southeastern oblasts. I mean, there were never strongholds of the Party of Regions or the communists. And I think that mindset that there is this crude black and white division and it explains everything led us to suppose that the Southeast would simply fall in line with the Donbass. And of course, even the Donbass is rather more variegated.
Right.
Sort of, you know, hardcore pro-Russian sentiment back in February was about 35% to 40%. It may still be that, it may not be that. We don't really know. But that's roughly a third of the population that wanted to secede, which is a lot.
Right.
One hand, but it's certainly less than the majority on the other hand.
Much less than the majority. One last thing I wanted to touch on before we go. It's something I've brought up on the podcast before, but it's getting pretty acute right now. And that is that Ukraine is central to any Russian imperial project. There can be no Russian imperial project. There can be no Russian imperial aspiration without Ukraine. Well, no matter how this ends up, short of an outright Russian occupation of the entire territory of Ukraine, which I think is beyond the realm of even speculation, Russia's lost Ukraine in a big way right now. It really has, no matter how this thing turns out. And could this, what effect is this going to have in Russia? Will it finally force Russia to get over this imperial complex and accept Ukraine as a separate state, as a separate nation, much like Germany had to do with Austria? Well, it's the closest analogy I could think. Or the opposite? Will it provoke continued hostility, much like we've seen in Serbia in the case of Kosovo, where they also trace their nationhood back to that territory? What do you think? Sean, what do you think this effect of losing Ukraine, as if it was theirs to lose, but you know what I mean? It's Russia's lost Ukraine, apparently. That's monumental in some ways.
I mean, you talked about this, I think it was 2 weeks ago, about the nationalist backlash and how serious this is and how much will it impact, if it could impact the way politics is run in Russia and the regime. I think there will always be a contingent within Russia that will always strive to include Ukraine. I mean, we've seen this for many years now. But there is a question, if the government loses Ukraine, if Putin loses Ukraine, how that might turn the tide against him is a big question. Certainly amongst the majority of the population, they might be satisfied with Russia not having an imperial project. The escalation of nationalism that's occurred over the last couple of months could be dialed down and people will go back to their regular lives and not worry about Russia and Ukraine. But for those hardcore nationalists, it does bring up the question of what they will do and how will this create a hangover over Russian society as a whole.
Mm. Alexander, your thoughts?
Well, this is a momentous transformation. I mean, you mentioned before that this is an existential moment for Ukraine, and of course it is. But by the same token, this particular war, and especially the escalation of the last few days, represents an existential moment for Putin. We've talked about that. But arguably for Russia as well, both in terms of its mentality, self-definition, and self-identity. What does it mean to be Russian when you've lost Ukraine? Now, in 1991, they lost the Ukrainian state, but one could still talk about the Ruski Mir, the Russian world, connections with Kyiv and Rus, and all those sorts of things. And, of course, there were all these familial and other kinds of ties. That's all disappearing. So regardless of the outcome of this conflict, whether the Donbas stays or goes, or whether there's some kind of frozen conflict or whatever, the fact of the matter is that what remains of Ukraine, and it's likely to be a very sizable chunk of today's Ukraine, will be unremittingly unwilling to engage in closer intercourse with Russia for a long period of time. I don't know if they're going to block off all diplomatic relations, but certainly relations will suffer. How will Russians cope with this? Will they abandon their imperial strivings? But more importantly, perhaps, how will they begin to define themselves? This is actually going to lead to a major crisis of confidence and crisis of identity within Russia, which could have all sorts of destabilizing consequences for the Russian state.
Or it could lead to a catharsis.
Or it could lead to a catharsis. And that, of course, is the best case scenario.
I love to be the optimist. And as Sean knows from years of participating in this podcast, sometimes naively so, the optimist. But I want to stop this podcast on an optimistic note. So I'm going to hope this is going to be a catharsis. So on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's unfortunately all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies. And joining us from New York City, also via Skype, has been Alexander Motil, a professor at Rutgers University, Newark, and author of numerous books on post-Soviet affairs. Thank you, gentlemen, for the enlightening discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and painfully overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Buturin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week when we will depart from our normal schedule with a special preview of the upcoming NATO summit. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.